things to me for January 6th anniversary. John Nichols, collaborator with a media critic and professor, now retired from teaching but still writing. John Nichols and what's his name? Well, I'll find it in a moment here.
Whether I was black or white, my shade cannot rewrite that what's wrong is wrong and what's right is right. And Shamar was wrong to think that the powers that be don't care, because they do. Just for property and merchandise, not about you. Young lad, who's now prison uniformed clad, for crossing all the lines like plaid, sentenced to a steel slab, and fined for far more than what he grabbed. He was given a bill as big as a hill. Judge told him, oh, don't worry about it, we'll put it on your tab. Then I guess in jest, they gave him years of rest for hours of unrest. Is that unjust? Some will say, nah, he's better off. He knew the difference between anger and danger was only one letter off. Plus, he set it off. Really? Are you that distraught that you don't reflect off and realize that it wasn't some post that sent fleets into the streets feeling the opposite of peace? But the daily release of videos that showed an existence-threatening increase of police calls and the lives from black bodies to cease. That's why they rose like yeast. And that's why they want that fact, like Rosa, to take a backseat. Under the threat of COVID-19, he was only 19, and yet overnight seen as some madman that went wild in this adult world where a child can make a post to become a poster child and a scapegoat. But take note how they wrote him off as a dissident. While I'm still trying to figure out what's the difference between him and our last president. One, they say, incited a riot on the Marketplace Mall that led to a loss of capital. The other, they say, incited a riot on the National Mall that led to a loss of the capital. One they make excuses for and give a pass, dismissed as, oh, he's just an ass who speaks off the cuff. Yes, they're innocent. His remarks agitate hate. Yeah, but with no rebuff. The other, they actually hunted and tracked before sun's dawn with guns drawn. Told him, hey, crawl out there on the front lawn to be done wrong like a spun pawn until a guilty plea was updrawn. The gavel hit, now that's one gone.
Poem by Christian Stubbs about Shamar Betts' case, which if you don't know about it, you can find three articles in the Public Eye. Go to the IMC and click on Public Eye and look for those articles. And as I mentioned, that poem, a version of it, will be in the upcoming Public Eye. So got Amy Goodman on Julian Assange for something completely different. I guess it's not completely different in the sense that press coverage and government machinations that need to be made transparent are certainly a topic of the day. Greg Palast with his videographer, Zach Roberts, if I haven't said it, will be on with Dennis Bernstein, January 6th, I guess, this Thursday past. The Start Making Sense podcast with John Nichols and John Weiner, the host, it's a conversation, was recorded before Biden's speech, which I haven't seen in its entirety, but the excerpt, I need to go back and listen to it. It was crafted by George H.W., speechwriter, along with Biden and maybe probably another bunch of imports. Well, I noticed that something that I heard on the Democracy Now! From one of the guests about the Confederate flag never being raised in the Capitol before until January 6th was in the speech. So I don't know if the scholar that said that had written about it and had gotten around, but I had never heard of that insight, and I think it was a good one to hang the speech on, if you will. All right, here's Amy Goodman breaking the sound barrier.
Stop Prosecuting the Press, Biden's Persecution of Julian Assange. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Gathering threats to democracy are front and center as the United States marks the first anniversary of the January 6th Capitol insurrection, when President Donald Trump incited thousands of supporters to violently storm Congress, attempting to overturn the 2020 election. While the Republican Party descends into the cult of Trump, progressive activists across the country are fighting to expand voting rights and protect free and fair elections. One of democracy's principal bulwarks is a free press. Sadly, with its ongoing prosecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, the Biden administration is leading the attack on journalism, strengthening the hand of would-be autocrats everywhere. Julian Assange is the founding editor and publisher of WikiLeaks, the pioneering transparency website. WikiLeaks exposed U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, torture at Guantanamo, and other abuses of power, releasing thousands of secret U.S. government and military documents that major news organizations worldwide, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Guardian, then used as the basis for award-winning reporting. Assange is currently locked up in England's maximum security Belmarsh prison, which has been described as the British version of Guantanamo Bay, as he fights the U.S. government's attempt to extradite him on espionage and hacking charges. If extradited, he faces up to 175 years in prison if found guilty. On Wednesday, activists marked Julian Assange's 1,000th day of incarceration at Belmarsh with a rally demanding his release. Prior to Belmarsh, he spent almost 7 years inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London under political asylum. Among those protesting was Stella Morris, Assange's fiancée and the mother of his two youngest children.
It's really taking a toll on him, and every day is a struggle. You can just imagine there's no end in sight. This can go on for years, potentially.
That's Stella Morris speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour in November, speaking from outside the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. Stella Morris announced the 1,000th day vigil in a tweet that included an audio recording reportedly made inside Assange's Belmarsh cell. Men screaming, guard dogs barking, and the incessant clang of metal doors slamming open and closed echo through the recording, painting a stark picture of the harsh conditions inside Belmarsh. Again, Stella Morris.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Torture has said that he is being psychologically tortured. His physical health is seriously deteriorated, and they are killing him. If he dies, it's because they are killing him. They are torturing him to death.
Stella Morris recently revealed that Julian Assange had suffered a mini-stroke in prison on October 27th, the first day of his high court appeal hearing. That court ultimately sided with the U.S. government, ordering that his extradition could proceed. Assange is currently seeking permission from that same high court to appeal the ruling to the UK's Supreme Court. Threats to journalists and media workers worldwide have been on the rise. The Committee to Protect Journalists stated that, as of December 8th, 24 journalists had been killed in the line of duty in 2021, with 8 more whose deaths may have been linked to their work. A record-breaking 293 journalists were imprisoned last year. President Joe Biden opened his Summit for Democracy on December 9th, saying,
"A free and independent media. It's the bedrock of democracy. It's how public stay informed and how governments are held accountable. And around the world, press freedom is under threat.
President Biden's words are true, but ring hollow as his Justice Department seeks to imprison Julian Assange for life, simply for performing those very functions of a free press that Biden praises. Referring to Maria Ressa of the Philippines and Dmitry Muratov of Russia for their courageous reporting while under threat from their governments, the deputy executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Robert Mahoney, said on December 9th, on the same day the Nobel Peace Prize honors journalists, a UK court ruled that the United States can extradite Julian Assange, a move that seriously damages journalism. Mahoney went on to say, the U.S. Justice Department's dogged pursuit of the WikiLeaks founder has set a harmful legal precedent for prosecuting reporters. The Biden administration pledged at its Summit for Democracy this week to support journalism. It could start by removing the threat of prosecution under the Espionage Act, now hanging over the heads of investigative journalists everywhere, said CPJ. A coalition of 24 groups, including Human Rights Watch, the ACLU, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, PEN America, and Reporters Without Borders, have called on the Biden administration to halt its Assange prosecution, saying it, quote, threatens press freedom because much of the conduct described in the indictment is conduct that journalists engage in routinely and that they must engage in order to do the work the public needs them to do, unquote. Democracy is under assault. President Biden must live up to his promise to support a free press, needed now more than ever, and drop the prosecution of Julian Assange. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well crafted. That's the regular column that I play. It still has to be manipulated sonically to make it listenable. I don't know why. I guess it's because... Anyway, Robert McChesney is the name that I have phased on there. Colleague of John Nichols. We'll get to him with John Wiener and the last part of the show, and hopefully we'll get to play all of it. Right now, it's time for... no theme has been reintroduced yet for the election theft report. It's actually broader than that. It was recorded... talking about January 6th and investigations into it. There's criticism, of course, of the Justice Department for saying some nice words, but what are they actually doing? One judge complained about the leniency of the sentencing and then gave a lenient sentence. So I gather there's a lot of cognitive dissonance in the system. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, of course. No time for pregnant pauses here today. Let's hear what Pallast and Dennis Bernstein have to say.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We broadcast every weekday on the Pacifica Radio Network from the San Francisco Bay Area. We are happy to have you along. The Flashpoints crew is here and ready to go. Joining us up top is our good friend and regular contributor, Greg Pallast. We have started 4 years ago the Election Crimes Bulletin, and this is really the kickoff for the new season of Election Crimes. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Greg. In your piece, right up on the website now at gregpallast.com, you are asking people to take a red pill and use their imagination. In fact, you're telling them to imagine that it's January 6, 2025, and Kamala Harris is counting the votes and counting the Electoral College votes, and then she comes to Georgia, and what happens?
Well, she comes to Georgia, and what happens is what Trump planned for last year but couldn't pull off, which is that there's a challenge to the slates. Last year, and by the way, the real coup d'etat attempt was not January 6th, it was January 4th, when Trump took a memo from one of his lawyers named John Eastman, and which said, you can use the 12th Amendment to the Constitution to stay in office. Here's how it works, and here's how it can work on January 6th of 2025 when Harris is required to read the electoral vote count from each state. There are often conflicting states. And last year, believe it or not, there were seven states which sent competing electoral votes to Pence in seven states. And that included, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, et cetera. Seven states. Now, if this happens again, and believe me, it's a very good chance that will happen in Georgia, where you have the state legislature send one slate, which is presuming that Trump, let's say Trump is running for re-election, we presume he will. Biden said he'll run Trump runs. Let's assume it's Trump and Biden again. And Biden once again wins by 12,000 votes in Georgia, as he did, 10,000 votes in Arizona, as he did. Let's say it's a repeat. But this time, the state legislatures send Trump slates to the Electoral College. Trump slates to Vice President Harris. Now, what happens when you have conflicting slates? Well, under the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, and believe me, don't feel bad if you don't know that what the 12th Amendment is, because very few people do or understand it. We have a new procedure. When there's a dispute, it's determined by a vote in the House of Representatives of the delegations of each state. And if you think that the Electoral College is unfair, wait to hear the 12th Amendment rule. The 12th Amendment rule says when there's a dispute over electors, it's one state, one vote. That means California, with 39 million people, gets one vote for president, and South Dakota, Wyoming, with 500,000 people each, get one vote for president, and Washington, D.C., gets no votes for president. And that's how the presidency will be determined, one state, one vote. And by the way, at this moment, there are 27 state delegations with Republican majorities. They only represent less than 1 out of 5 voters because it's small states. Republicans have the Dakotas and Wyoming and Utah, and they tend to have the smaller states.
Right.
So you could have 27 if we go with the 12th Amendment, which is more than likely. If we have that problem, Trump will be reinaugurated in 2025.
Now, when you raised this back when I was a young man, people really couldn't handle it. They thought, nope. There goes Palast again, jumping off the deep end. This isn't even in the realm of possibility, but this was the plan. This was the freaking plan.
One of the great ironies, and talk about media, when I suggested that the 12th Amendment, that Trump might try to use the 12th Amendment to stay in power, despite the vote of both the popular vote and the electoral vote, that he might use the 12th Amendment. This is even before November. I was banned from my job at Salon. And you have to understand, in 2018, I was Salon's nominee for the Pulitzer Prize. In 2020, when I mentioned the 12th Amendment, they banned me. I was now a conspiracy nut. But here's the punchline.
Let me just clarify here. You mean we're talking about Salon, They banned you specifically for this?
For the 12th Amendment. Yes, exactly. Now, what happened was, because it's like, Greg Palast, conspiracy theory, and all I was doing is saying, here's the legal course which I would expect Trump to try. And believe it or not, they found CNN and then Bob Woodward found this memo, got a hold of this memo from John Eastman. And there was a meeting. John Eastman is one of Trump's lawyers who said, you can stay in office using the 12th Amendment. And then Trump called Pence in to the Oval Office and also had several calls with him, with Eastman, saying, here's what you've got to do. You've got to, Pence, you've got to invoke the 12th Amendment. And when you invoke the 12th Amendment, you don't accept the Electoral College votes for Biden from Arizona and other states. That will kick off the 12th Amendment procedure. Now, you didn't need Pence to actually kick that off. The reason why they wanted Pence to do it is that they were very nervous, correctly, that a lot of Republican legislators would not go along with this type of steal. And as you know, even Lindsey Graham and others, would not vote against the certification of Biden as president and his electors. However, they've now seen, when you look at what's happened to Liz Cheney and others, those who certified, Republicans who voted to certify Biden as president, are pretty much unemployed. They're out of office. And so any Republican politician seeing this will now be tempted to fall in line. So this is a real possibility. It's happened before in American history three times, where we've had someone who's won the electoral vote and the popular vote not become president because of Amendment 12. And then there's also the issue of Article 2, which we could get into. But this is scary enough. This is scary enough.
Let me jump in here.
Yeah.
Okay, let me jump in here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're joined by Greg Palast. Greg and I have been doing what we call the Election Crimes Bulletin since 2016. I've been working with Greg for longer than that, but I really decided it was time to formalize it, and Greg just jumped in like a trooper, and we put together this continuing series. And we're looking at all the levels at which your vote, people's votes, are being stolen, the way it's being engineered, the new 21st century variations on a theme, Jim Crow. It's important that we keep an eye on this. The Democrats have been very slow to the draw. I don't even know where they are at the moment. But Greg, let me ask you, let's put a spotlight on the actual investigation. We know that the legend of the Supreme Court from Harvard, Lawrence Tribe, is really, you might say, just a teensy bit frustrated at the lack of activity and the focus and the sharpness of the actions of the Attorney General to go after the real criminals of this day. You want to talk about this?
Yes. Now we are, and by the way, we'll be hearing shortly from Zach Roberts, who's on the ground there in D.C. and has been following these guys for 10 years, often undercover, the guys that led to the mayhem. So, one, it's the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, but not the U.S. Attorney General, who's brought civil actions against the groups that instigated and planned the attack on the Capitol, the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, and others. And we're waiting for Merrick Garland. We're also waiting for Merrick Garland to find out why it was that his FBI violated their own procedure and allowed perpetrators of murder. Remember, let's not forget, a cop had his head crushed by a fire extinguisher. There was murder, and yet they allowed the perps to walk out of the crime scene when the FBI manual is strict. When you have a murder or any felony crime, the entire crime scene is sealed off, and every person who was there, a perpetrator, witnesses, whatever, would be sequestered, booked, and their cell phones, which have the evidence of the killings and the break-in, their cell phones taken. That's FBI procedure. That's the Justice Department. Why isn't Merrick Garland taking this action and going against the planners instead of, you know, this stuff of, like, minor misdemeanors for the break-in at the Capitol, you know, being bad tourists, as it, you know, it's that's all he's doing. We're wondering why.
Well, there's a lot of concern about that. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints. Let's bring in Zach Roberts. Zach, I hope you're there. Can you join us?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Oh, perfect. Beautiful. So some of your boys have been getting a bit of attention. What's happening at the, if you will, at the grassroots of the extreme right wing? They took a loss down south. How are they responding to who's being prosecuted, who's not, what's going on? Are they ready for the next round? Should we all be nervous?
Well, I mean, what I'm worrying about more is a lot more of what Greg is saying, is that this slow coup that's going to happen. A lot of the organizers of the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers are either in jail or on their way to jail. And so the kind of the groups are slowly filtering into other movements. I mean, they're staying Proud Boys and they're staying Oath Keepers. You see a lot of the far right now kind of attaching itself to the anti-vax movement. You have somebody like Nick Fuentes, who was, if you remember, the guy standing next to Ali Alexander and Alex Jones in across the street from the Georgia Georgia Governor's Mansion. He's now already been leading a march in New York City of anti-vaxxers. So they're kind of evolving through to something else, and basically slowly picking up new members, and through either whether it be anti-vax or the shutdown, you know, the imagined shutdown, because we haven't ever actually had real shutdowns in this country, and basically using those conspiracies to pick up new people, because, well, they've lost a lot of people. But the fact is that they're still marching. They're doing it a little bit more low-key, but we're going to see, you know, as we march towards, literally and figuratively, towards the 2024 election, and the moment that Donald Trump announces, while they may not like him right now, they know he's a useful idiot for them. And he will bring out the masses, which is what they need. They need that MAGA crowd of, you know, wealthy suburbaners who have the money to take private planes to Washington, D.C. on January 6th last year, and then, you know, break into the Capitol. They need those numbers. They need those numbers from the masses. And right now they don't have them, but they will once again, unless something is done to stop them on a real larger level, unless the organizational network and money that is funding these groups, that is allowing them to work with people in power. You know, I mean, again, like we talked about earlier, Georgia, you know, Ali Alexander was working hand in hand with the Georgia GOP and the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee. This is a national network working directly with fascists. And we haven't seen anything. It's great that the D.C. Attorney General is doing something, but really would be great to see something from something more from Merrick Garland or the White House.
There was some impact in terms of what happened in Charlottesville, because that was all about, you know, going at the funding and trying to sort of impoverish that whole movement. So that had some impact. I wonder if that's where the government is going to use its forces against that level of folks. What worries me, Greg, is that we're afraid of the violence, and they've demonstrated that they could be violent, and there's a lot of soldiers who are trained and a lot of cops who are involved, a lot of violent people, but this is a mainstream movement that Trump is empowering. He's got a lot of support.
Well, two things. Let's go back to your point about going after their money of these right-wing groups. Yes, there was a big victory in Charlottesville, and people remember the trial in which the Proud Boys, the KKK, the other ultra-right violent groups were found liable, and they are now subject to bankrupting judgments of millions of dollars. However, what's not happy about that is that that was brought by private organizations like the ACLU and individuals and anti-fascist groups brought civil actions. We never got a civil suit or a civil racketeering suit. Remember, for those who know Greg Palast, know my stuff, I used to work with the Justice Department on civil racketeering. In the good old days, we would have brought civil racketeering charges against these guys and put them out of business, and also take the criminal aspects of the racketeering laws, the racketeering conspiracy. I mean, it's classic racketeering conspiracy. And yet, I don't know why our Justice Department is sitting there frozen, not taking action with the laws we have. We don't need special laws to go after these guys. You cannot break into the Capitol or into any building and start killing cops and stopping people from voting. It's a direct violation of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. Garland never heard of that law. He's a federal judge, a former federal judge. I'm very concerned that our government, I don't know what the fear is. I don't know what the weight is. It's 1 year where the clock is ticking, and on the civil actions, we're getting into the area of statute of limitations. I'm very worried about the actions not taken by the Justice Department to smash these groups, and including, by the way, as Zach Roberts uncovered, and we reported, and as we've reported on Flashpoints, is that the Republican National Committee and the Republican Senate Campaign Committee were working directly with the instigators of a January 6th riot. That has to be investigated.
Well, they're getting edgy now, right? They're starting, there's one of these investigations that's ongoing is really starting to draw out some of those people who are involved in the actual setting up of the rally.
But again, that's not our Justice Department. That is the Congressional Investigation Committee headed by Congressman Benny Thompson. There's only a couple Republicans on who are, who voted to impeach Trump and they're political toast. So, the committee will do a nice little bit of it's subpoenaed Ollie Alexander and others. How much they will make public. I was disappointed that, for example, they put Ollie Alexander's testimony under seal. We didn't know what he said. I'm hoping it was just so that those I hope he ratted on some of his right-wing killer friends, like Roger Stone, who he's very close to, and Donald Trump, who spoke to him often. I don't know what he said, and we'd like to know what he said. But again, that's not the Justice Department taking direct action. It's simply, that's a committee that can't bring indictments. That's a committee that can't levy fines. It's simply a commission of inquiry. That's all they're doing. And I'm waiting for our government agencies to use their powers, which are far more powerful because they hold over witnesses' heads the power to put you in jail.
This is Zach here. I want to add.
Please.
Everyone should sit down and actually read the amazing. Like, usually, I have no good words for these people for things, but the amazing district attorney general, attorney generals. I'm sorry, district. The DC attorney general. The document that they put out. It laid out. Not only does clearly they have someone on their staff that knows their stuff. they know the difference between three percenters and militia. They know their stuff on this, but they laid out in detail, just like the IFA did in the Charlottesville lawsuit, in detail, the conversations that the groups had, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and all the other ones had working together. Literally, I mean, this is when we're talking about racketeering, when we're talking about all these things. This is literally laid out. And they have the text messages, they have the private Discord chats and all these things that happen behind the scenes. It's all laid out in a 80 page or so document. I would hope that somebody over at Merrick Garland's office can sit down and read this and go, oh, well, here's our document. We just need to take this and then turn it into a criminal action, not just a civil action, which is really great to bankrupt these guys. Except the problem is what we see is, like in the last case, Richard Spencer, one of the organizers of Unite the Right in Charlottesville, he's already bankrupt. I mean, like, a lot of these guys just don't have money, and a lot of the organizations don't have money, but they have money coming in, which is also the big thing that we can find out more and more if we actually have an attorney general that can get bank records and things like that. How are these groups funded? How are the Proud Boys able to fly back and forth across the country? How are they able to, how the Oath Keepers able to afford weapons and kits and hotel rooms and all these things? Is it just them spending all their personal cash? I don't think so. These guys aren't necessarily, these guys aren't like the MAGA people who are like, can afford private planes and that sort of thing. A lot of these guys are just, they work at a bar, they work at whatever, and they've lost a lot. The Proud Boys have been kicked out of any place that basically they can work, that they're going to be open, because they know that they're going to be outed through social media. And then most places, it's like if they work at a McDonald's or they work at some chain restaurant, it's going to go, yeah, we really don't want a Proud Boy working at our place. So I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. You're part of a literal fascist organization. We can't have you here.
What do we know about funding? The way in which somebody who's just a bartender can become an activist and travel. Is there special sources of funding that continue to make their work possible?
I mean, the Proud Boys, they get donations. Like I was out in Portland the previous year, for Greg Palast and documented them just getting handed wads of cash, which they said, oh, it's going to be beer money and we'll have fun with it. And so there's a minimal level of funding on that end. And then, you know, I mean, this is like their pet project. This is like, you know, some people rebuild, you know, classic cars. These guys like to get in fights in the streets and burn Black Lives Matter flags. This is their thing. There's that. But they also, this is something that like a lot of really good journalists have done really good work on, but I'm looking into as well, is that now we have the problem of cryptocurrency. We have people getting, you know, untraceable, for the most part, cash in the amounts of tens of thousands of dollars for a lot of these groups. Suddenly, just out of the blue, they get all this money right before something like January 6th or right before some big rally. And it's untraceable for the most part. It's very difficult to find out who gave the money or whatever. You know, there's some people that have better brains than me that know how to follow this stuff better. But it's still, at the end of the day, we know from a generic Bitcoin account to another Bitcoin account the money transferred, but it's very difficult often to find out whether it's, you know, is this the Mercers? I mean, like, is this a larger funding organization funding it, or is it just some random, is it Peter Thiel who really likes to fund fascist organizations and you know, and people like Chris Kobach and JD Vance out in Ohio? And so we just don't know yet, and that's something that like normal journalism can't do. But I think that, you know, something like the Justice Department should be able to get a handle on that.
Well, this is Greg Palast. One thing on following the money. We're talking about funding, of course, the kind of brown shirt fringe, just like Hitler had his black shirts, you know, who were the muscle boys who you know, beat up people, lynched people, destroyed and burned. But the real threat, as you know, and it's always dangerous to get into World War II comparisons, was, of course, the industrialists behind Hitler. And so the industrialists behind a Trump resurgence, you have to look at the Bradley family, which was, you know, Bradley Machinery, who they have put $2 billion into right-wing causes. Remember, at the core of this, you have to have vote suppression. So in Georgia, you have 360,000 people who've been targeted by this voter vigilante hunter business, very much like the Texas law where you have the vigilantes against people who might have abortions. In Georgia, it's targeting voters, vigilantes, not the state. And they have, under the new Georgia law, SB 202, the right to challenge voters. They've challenged a third of a million, almost all of them black voters, certainly Democrats. Who's backing this? True the Vote out of Texas. Who's backing True the Vote? The Bradley Foundation, the Bradley family, billionaires. So it's money from Wisconsin to Texas, operating and controlling the Georgia vote purging operation, which will then pass to other states. So we have to look at that, at those big monies. We're all familiar now, after years of me screaming about the Koch brothers, now we know them. Now I want you to meet the new Kochs, the Bradley family and the Bradley Foundation, which is supporting legal attacks on our system, et cetera. And don't forget, this is all leading, as we said at the beginning of the show, to using the 12th Amendment, and which is boosted by, we have another unknown article, you know, Article 2 of the Constitution. I'm not talking about the one, Amendment 2, which allows you to carry around a weapon, supposedly, but Article 2, which says legislatures, not voters, choose the electors for our state. So look out. That's another pitfall that we have to look out for 2024, which means we have to stop vote suppression in 2022, because if suppression wins and Warnock is not reelected, in Georgia, I think you're going to have an Article 12, Amendment 12 election. And that's
exactly where I wanted to go. That's going to be the defining moment. What happens in Georgia, what they're allowed to get away with. It's going to be the big test case for implementation of all the variations on a theme that we've seen throughout the country in terms of these, you know, these new laws. And this is, and unfortunately still, I mean, Biden sort of made a strong speech today, but you have to still put it in the too little too late category of, political weak-kneed actions that are going to be useless if this is all that happens. And I don't understand how he is tolerating the Attorney General's lack of action. I don't understand. There's something here, Greg. This has gone on too long that you've got this kind of Attorney General with, you know, man, if I said, okay, everybody, now we're going to go down to the White House and we're going to smash the hell out of it because we need a war and they're going to make the wrong decision in their tally if you don't go in there. And the president says it, and he says, I'm going to walk with you. And then everybody walks away. Do they know where the president is now? Do they know? Maybe, Greg, they just don't know where he is to arrest him.
Well, you know, that I got to tell you, that is one of the real concerns I had. And we've discussed that before, especially...
It makes me crazy.
Zach Roberts, is that we know that Trump personally... Okay, first he tries to pull this Amendment 12... game, but Pence is blocking him, and you've got some squeamish Republicans. That won't happen in 2024. The second is that we know Trump himself was informed that a march to the Capitol was illegal. Trump was, and we know Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, was informed. We have the text messages, and new text messages have just been found, but we uncovered them first. The president of the United States got up and violated the law and said, march the Capitol, which is dangerous because there were no monitors. The police weren't informed, the Capitol Police, the D.C. police weren't informed. And no one knew what was, you know, that you were going to have thousands of people marching toward the Capitol without any control. Well, what do you think is going to happen? And yet I haven't seen any questions to Donald Trump. If you remember Mueller... This is a repeat of the Mueller game when he was supposed to interview.
It sure is.
He decided not to interview Donald Trump because he says, well, I know that he'll take the fifth. I know that we won't get much out of him.
It's right.
What are you talking about?
It's not worth it.
Interview a witness. I don't care if he's president. I don't care if he's pope. You interview the witnesses. When I worked at the Justice Department, we never said, oh, you can't ask that witness a question. What are you talking about? There's a crime. People died, and our democracy almost died. I think that Donald Trump needs to be questioned. There's no such thing as executive privilege in the planning of a crime. You don't get executive privilege for that. Sorry. Doesn't happen.
Right now, it's not almost died, Greg. I would say it is the democracy is dying, and we're watching the slow bleed. It's like, really, it is. It really, it's like standing on the train tracks, and you can see the train way in the distance, but you know it's on the same track as you, and you're going to get hit by that freaking train. And, you know, again, they're just sleeping. They're asleep at the wheel here. This is not an attorney general. I'm telling you, he's not going forward. If he hasn't started, if he's not really into it now, by now, he's not going forward. I don't know what they would be waiting for to begin the necessary processes, because there is, as we've been talking about, going to be elections coming up.
Well, I think that
they have consequences.
I think that who knows what, there might be a political calculation here that you don't want to put Trump in the stand, you don't want to put him on trial, you don't want to seem like you're persecuting him, whatever. I don't know. A political consideration should not be involved in the investigation of a homicide crime. A homicide, let's not forget. And in addition, what I'm very concerned about, going back when we talk about this 12th Amendment election, again, it's one state, one vote, and that means that with Republicans controlling state delegations, the Republican can win, is that, you know, this has happened more than once in American history. In 1824, Andrew Jackson won both the popular vote and the electoral vote, and the Congress simply refused to make him president. They had an Amendment 12 vote call in the House, and most states voted for John Quincy Adams, even though he'd lost. 4 years later, they couldn't stop Jackson from taking office. So that was one, but that's way back. But let me get you closer. 2000. Most people don't really know what the Supreme Court decision was in Bush v. Gore. Here's what happened in a nutshell. The second article to the Constitution says legislatures, not voters, pick the electors for president. That wasn't an accident. John Adams has said, and if you go to gregpalace.com, you can read this kind of frightening quote from Adams, who says, you know, democracy is the instrument of stage players, atheists, deists, Jews, and other undesirables. That's a quote, who are trying to, quote, destroy the nobility, meaning people like John Adams and the landed gentry. So while, as one Oxford professor said, the Declaration of Independence written by Jefferson gave America democracy, the Constitution took it away by design. They were afraid of the people. And in 2000, the Florida legislature sent George W. Bush electors to the Electoral College, despite the fact that there were that Bush had only was the that they had stopped the vote count, stopped the vote count when Bush was ahead by only 537 votes. 178,000 ballots had yet to be counted, most of them in Jacksonville and other African American towns. After the Supreme Court ruling, I was part of the team that counted those ballots. Al Gore won Florida, and therefore should have been president of the United States. But the Supreme Court accepted the Article II provisions that it's the Florida legislature which chooses the electors and therefore the president. It's the legislatures, those great Solons that we have in those legislatures, most of which are controlled by Republicans today, which by the Constitution choose our president, not the voters. You have no right to vote in the United States Constitution. That wasn't by accident. It ain't there. You don't get to vote for president, not directly.
Ken, we're going to have to get out of here, but I want to ask you to respond to the possibilities of if any of this legislation, pro-voting legislation, either one of these two bills makes it through and becomes law. Does that help us?
Absolutely. There's two bills. The most important by far is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. That restores the original Voting Rights Act of 1965, in particular what's called the preclearance provisions. Don't get scared by the term preclearance. It simply means that if you're going to pull off shenanigans, as they've done in Georgia, where, for example, they close voting stations in black areas, they have to get that pre-cleared, approved by the Justice Department, which has to say, yes, that has no negative effect on black voters or young voters. That's the law, or female voters. So if you're closing, you can't get away with closing polling stations in black areas because it won't get through the pre-clearance process. That's what we used to have. The Supreme Court took it away in 2013. The John Lewis Act would restore that. The other bill, which stands almost no chance of passage, is a 500-page monster. It does some very good things. It also prohibits gerrymandering. It exposes, brings to light who the real donors and campaigns are, et cetera. I don't see Manchin voting to break the filibuster on that. He said he might consider it on the John Lewis bill. This would be huge to restore these basic rights to Americans. Say you can't mess with the laws in a state if it deliberately attacks the right to vote of people of color. But we don't have that now.
My political sensibilities tells me that Manchin actually might go forward on that because he needs redemption, and that would be his way of having his cake and eat it, honoring his corporate supporters and sort of doing something in this world.
I've never tried to dive into Joe Manchin's brain. It's a very tight space.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know.
I take it all back.
A very tight space indeed. I have an image of him gunning his Maserati in frustration, I suppose, for all of the flack he's getting. Well deserved. That was Dennis Bernstein and Greg Palast. Might have some Palast on from an archival recording tomorrow on the show, and has something to say about Kazakhstan. I heard today the U.S. doesn't have much relationship with Kazakhstan. Well, there were people feeding on the post-Soviet Union chaos. It was one of the grievances that the Russian people have, actually. But another day, another subject. let's get back to another source on January 12th. This is with John Nicholson. We won't get all of it on. He talks about Amendment 14 in the clause. I mentioned Cori Bush from St. Louis area has got a resolution calling for the implementation of the parts of the 14th Amendment that bar people from serving if they have been giving succor or being involved with attempts to disrupt the operations of government. More details on that in the future, hopefully.
The term, the fierce urgency of now, has not exactly overwhelmed the members of the United States Senate.
I am shaking my head in dismayed agreement.
Yeah, it's just, it's sort of surreal. You're like, wow, this is a crisis. It's a really, really bad thing. Democracy itself is at stake. And so in a couple of weeks, if we don't see some action, we might do something. That's kind of where we're at. I don't want to beat up on Schumer too much. I've interviewed him a couple of times about this, and I know the dance that he believes he is involved in with Joe Manchin. And that is that, you know, you give Manchin a lot of time, a lot of space, a lot of clarity that no Republican is going to do the right thing. And then you kind of put Manchin in a position where theoretically he might do what he has said he would do, which is back some protections for voting rights. But then you have the problem of Kyrsten Sinema, who is more militantly opposed to altering the filibuster rules than Manchin is. And so we are still a good distance from where we need to be. Now, in fairness to Schumer, well, I criticize him for not being urgent enough on this and for not really kind of getting to this point on January 17th of 2021, not 2022. That's when that's when they should have, you know, right at that critical moment after the attack on the Capitol, you know, in the moment of impeachment, that's when they should have locked in, you know, used their majorities to lock in some voting rights reforms, which then a newly inaugurated President Biden could have signed on his first day in office. But they didn't do that. So now we're here. And one hopes that Schumer is using these couple weeks to really kind of work Sinema. And I think Sinema is the most important one on this one, to get her across the line so that she will allow for a carve out on voting rights on this.
But I've read that it's not just Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema who are holding this up. How many of the 50 votes are assured votes for changing the filibuster rules?
Well, you open up the real can of worms there, John, because throughout this last year, Manchin and Sinema have served as sort of placeholders for a group of senior Democratic senators, all of them, as best I can tell, folks who've been around for a while, at least a term or so, who are not particularly enthusiastic about altering the filibuster. That's a baseline reality. Most of them, I think, are sympathetic to voting rights. I don't think that's really the problem per se, but they operate on a very kind of old-fashioned sensibility about the Senate in most cases. And then there's a couple who are afraid that if they alter the filibuster, it will become an issue in their reelection runs in 2022. I'd say there's about six of them. I think the senators from New Hampshire are a little bit shaky. I think John Tester from out in Montana is somebody that people keep an eye on, although he's actually stood up and said and done some pretty good stuff. The two senators from Delaware who are very loyal to Biden have often been very resistant to filibuster reform over the years. So you got a group there. But as I run down it, John, I kind of default to the position that if Manchin and Sinema can be moved, then the others will come. None of them seem to me to be the kind of person who would say, oh, you've settled it all. It's all the pieces are in place. Now I'm going to throw a wrench into the machine.
One more thing. So the Senate rules have always said that a simple majority can change the rules, including the rule on the filibuster. Has this ever happened before?
Oh, yes. Yeah. There's a lot of history on it. And remember, we used to, in the lifetimes of some living Americans, have a system on the filibuster where you had to get up and stand there and talk forever. You know, Strom Thurmond did it on, you know, defending, you know, states' rights and segregation and everything horrible. So there was a change of the rules to make it easier for bad players to kind of filibuster without actually filibustering. And so, yeah, the history is full of it, full of examples of this. This can be done. It's not even that big a deal, especially if you do a carve out. You know, if you just say, well, we're just going to do it on voting rights. But I will tell you that the carve out is fraught with a certain amount of peril. And that is that if they do a carve out on voting rights, I think they are going to face pressure from people who say, you know, come on, you can't do it on racial justice and reform of policing. You can't do it on labor rights, the PRO Act. You can't do it on, so, you know, I think that that's where, while it's easy to do a carve out, it does also open up, you know, the next levels of pressure on a host of issues.
So we've posited defending voting rights as the most immediate way to protect ourselves against the changes that January 6th inaugurated in American political life. What do we know about the larger question of public opinion on what January 6th meant and what it was about? How many people actually believe American democracy is under threat?
A lot of people believe it's under threat, John. In fact, the numbers are, you know, roughly two-thirds of folks, according to some recent polling, will say that, yeah, they think that there's a real danger, and they think that after the next presidential election, you could have violence. So, you know, that's a lot of people believe that. There's also a shockingly large number of people who believe that's okay. And that's sort of the two sides of this coin. The clear majority of Americans do see a threat to democracy. Maybe not all of them think that Republicans are the threat. There may even be some folks who poll and say there's a threat coming from the Democrats. But the bottom line is there's a lot of people who see an instability. And then there is a portion, and polls are a little bit variable on this, but there are certainly in the double digits and perhaps into the relatively high double digits of people who think that violence is either appropriate or somehow acceptable in these circumstances. These tend to generally be very conservative Republicans. But yeah, we're in an incredibly unstable point. And I think that the truth, John, is that the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress really blew January 6th. They didn't blow it on impeachment. They were right to move rapidly for impeachment. They should have moved more rapidly. They should have done the impeachment when they did in the House, and then they should have done the trial before Trump finished his presidency. They should have just moved immediately on that issue. They didn't. But then the deeper problem is that they didn't hold their own to account.
Now we have this House Special Committee investigating that event and producing a lot of extremely important information about who was responsible for what that day. What has that committee achieved so far? How do you evaluate their work?
They have achieved some significant things, but they have done it in such a plodding way, such a slow way, that they have kind of sucked the urgency out of a lot of this. And that's really problematic. Again, that committee should have been constituted back in January of last year. The revelations that they're getting should have been gotten last year, not now on the one-year anniversary. That has allowed for a lot of misinformation to fill the void, a lot of disinformation to fill the void. And they continue to send mixed signals about how much power they have to extract accountability once they find out about things. At this point, I hate to say it, but it seems to me that the committee is more of a record-keeping endeavor than it is an actual accountability endeavor. They're getting the information. It's profound. It is significant. It clearly points to wrongdoing, not merely by members of the Trump administration and President Trump himself, but also by members of Congress. And so this is a big, big deal.
He then goes on and talks about Cori Bush and this part of the 14th Amendment that would allow barring legislators who connived, if I use that word, with the people who wanted to stop the proceedings. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. That was John Nichols with John Wiener. The show is called Start Making Sense. Sorry, I ran out of time to play all of it. You can find it where you find your old podcast, Start Making Sense, through The Nation magazine as well. And yeah, stay strong, stay safe. It's time for a little underwriting nonsense from the Park District. Walking in the park is still one of those things you can do. And Mark's in to do some jazz programming after the information block that Gina will be running after 2 hours of a repeat of another labor show. Health greetings go out. Well wishes to Bob Pilesny, who is testing positive but asymptomatic right now. He had some symptoms. Hopefully he'll have a negative antigen test this week. PCR tests can be positive for months after your infection is actual active and you're passing the thing. There are remnants of this wicked virus that stay in one's system, so the antigen test is actually better after the fact. No medical advice should be taken without